Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's fantastic to be back with you here. We're all back fresh from EMS World Expo a week or so ago, and we recorded a bunch of episodes down there. So this episode's probably going to come out in a few weeks from when we record this, after we've played back some of those episodes from recording at Expo. We had a fantastic time there in the Physio Control Podcast studio, and we're back here with our regular staff and regular crew. And of course that means, yes, that's right, that person you hear laughing right there is Sam Bradley.
Oh my, yes, that's me. And define fresh, Jamie. I'm still kind of recovering. That was one heck of a busy week, but we did go. I think that was my favorite expo ever, especially on the podcasting side, because I think we knocked out 6 or 7 disaster podcasts and met a whole bunch of cool people. And I saw more people that I've known for 20 years plus from all of the different jobs that I've had. It was just mind-blowing. I mean, it was like a reunion that they all came to Vegas. So maybe that was it, just because it was in Vegas. So we have Dr. Joe with us, who's just short of taking an awesome trip to Australia. We were just talking about that, so we can't wait for him to go and come back and hear about your experiences, Joe.
Well, it sounds great. Hi, guys. Good to be back with you again. Definitely looking forward to 8 days in Australia on a mixed business and pleasure trip. So hopefully some great guests when we come back, as well as just some really neat conversations on my visits in there. I'm going to get a chance to see some EMS services and interact with a lot of EMS folks while I'm down there. So should be great.
So you're going to be in Victoria. What part of Australia is that? Not that I could tell one from the other, but just curious.
Well, I'll be part of my time I'll be in Sydney, and part of my time will be in Melbourne.
Oh, okay.
I think all those are in the Victoria province, or whatever the right term is.
Oh, that's what.
Well, Sydney's in New South Wales. I know that much.
Okay.
So I think Melbourne is in Victoria.
Okay. Well, I did not know my provinces or areas that well.
I think they're states, actually, believe it or not.
States. All right. Well, I have some study to do.
Yeah, I think. I could be wrong there. I'm sure we've probably got a few Australian listeners out there, so you can shoot us an email to podmedic@mac.com and complain if I'm wrong or whatever, or correct us, and we'll get it right the next time.
Yeah, and please let us know if you're out there, and maybe we can hook you up with Dr. Joe, and he can say hi. That'd be awesome.
That would be awesome.
If you're where he happens to be. So he'll be an expert on all this by the time you get back, Joe.
Oh, I'm sure I'll be speaking with an accent and using a bunch of strange terms that no one but me understands.
I got news for you, Joe. You speak with an accent now.
An Australian southern accent. That ought to be interesting.
Right. I'll be in South Australia, so it'll make sense.
And you'll have a new understanding of kangaroos or something.
Yeah. Probably. And quokkas. And
koalas. And
all that other.
Cool.
But well, we've got
a little bit of news. We've got a couple of things going on tonight,
oh,
Sam.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, but
yes.
I thought we'd kick off with some news. At the time we're recording this, so we always have to say that because we're usually recording in a couple weeks of offset. But at the time of recording this, just looking at the weather, the East Coast is looking at Tropical Storm Joaquin, still east of the Bahamas at the time we recorded this. Not really sure where it's going to hit, if it even makes landfall on the Atlantic coast. It might sideswipe Cape Hatteras and in North Carolina, and then maybe head back out to sea. So we'll see. It could swing in and impact me here in on the eastern part of Maryland. We're not really sure. But, you know, it comes back to this is still right in the height of the hurricane season. And even though it's been a relatively quiet season this year, it doesn't mean that we couldn't spin up a hurricane in the Atlantic and cause some major problems. So preparedness is always something that we have to keep in mind.
That's true, and I think we'll be looking at potential all the way through October. Would you not say that's true, Joe?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly the later ones tend to be the worst ones, and I think the thought on Joaquin is a pretty heavy possibility of major rainfall and flash flooding, et cetera, up in your neck of the woods there, Jamie.
Yeah, I think so, and then even if it goes off the coast, because these storms tend to push a lot of clouds and a lot of moisture out away from them, and because of that counterclockwise flow, it's actually going to be sweeping all that moisture into the East Coast. So even if it's off the coast a good ways, it's still going to bring a substantial amount of rain, or has the potential to the central mid-Atlantic area.
Absolutely.
Wow. We actually had our first nice fall day today. It's been kind of overcast, and it's only 81, so for the first time in weeks, it's been under 90. I think we actually had the warmest July we've ever had here, so it's kind of nice for things to cool down, and I'm waiting for that El Nino, so when you hear me say I'm sick of rain, that'll be a good thing.
Awesome.
So we'll see. So we're going to talk about blood, which reminds me, Jamie, of your book. How's your book doing?
Well, my book's doing great, speaking of blood and all things unusual with werewolves and vampires and whatnot. It's and the paramedics who treat them. So it's actually been doing very well. In fact, every time a friend of mine posts something about the book that they've read it and they've enjoyed it and thanks for, you know, me hooking them up with it where they can buy it, and a few people have come by the house and gotten me to sign copies for them and things like that, and every time they post it, two or three of their friends go, wow, that looks like a cool book, what's it called again, and I want to look it up. And so a lot of word of mouth, which is really, you know, it's a slow burn for a new novel with a new novelist. You don't have a built-in audience. So I'm looking forward to that. But the book is called Extreme Medical Services. I'll give it a quick plug. And anybody that's interested in that kind of thing might want to just go check it out. It's an ebook or a physical book and available wherever you either on Amazon or wherever you buy ebooks.
And it's great fun. And I think you're right, Jamie. I think the EMS community, because we deal with so much heavy stuff, and this is just fun. It's a fun story. And I think the people that are reading it are going to pass, you know, tell other people. And I think that's where you're going to gain most of your audience, because they'll just say, hey, this is great. Go get it. Have fun with it. So we'll see how that goes.
But thanks for asking. I appreciate it.
Well, I always throw a plug in for you. You know that. And when we're talking about blood, it just makes me think of that. But what we're talking about, because Jamie found an article that we were going to use as a news story, but I thought it was so interesting, we decided to devote a podcast to it. And that is the idea of paramedics transporting with blood. Now, in the areas where I am, where there's really short, you know, transport times, it wouldn't be as necessary. But maybe out there where you are, Joe, and some of the more rural areas, it would be make a big difference on a trauma patient. Because, as we know, given saline or, you know, something similar isn't going to help. It certainly doesn't put any hemoglobin in your system. And, you know, there's blood clotting factors and so forth. Just on that note, Joe, what can you tell us in terms of what doesn't happen that should happen when we don't have blood in the field? And say there's a 20-minute transport time.
Well, a lot of the issue with that is, you know, replacing volume to date has been with lactated ringers and normal saline, et cetera. You know, an effort just to get something in the pipes for the system to pump around. Of course, the problem with it is that, as you've already said, it doesn't contain many of the vital elements that blood contains. So there's no red blood cells to carry hemoglobin and therefore oxygen. There's nothing in the way of clotting factors. There's nothing in the way of white blood cells. All the various and sundry chemical and biological components of blood that are vitally important. Of course, the other issue with that is that you, in essence, dilute what is left by filling the tank back up with saline. So you dilute out clotting factors, you dilute the red blood cell count to the point where you can't meet the needs of the body, whether that's from a clotting standpoint or a oxygen-carrying capacity standpoint.
Well, I'm finding in the research that I did, because I got kind of interested in it when Jamie sent that article, where you're going in Australia, and hopefully you'll be able to find out more about that when you're there, the UK, Germany, and actually a place in Texas. But they seem to be all air ambulance services. So they have the ability. Now, I don't know how this would translate to an ambulance, but it would seem as though it's possible. Because according to what they're saying, there's a very small temperature range. I think it's it can't be any lower than 2 degrees centigrade and no higher than 8 degrees. So you have to stay within that very strict guideline. And apparently they have the equipment to be able to do that. And they, another thing too is that wasting any of it would be a huge issue. So what they do is if they put it on board for 1 or 2 days, even though I didn't know this, but blood products have a shelf life of 42 days. So they rotate their stock. I know in Australia where they, at a certain point in time, they give it back to the hospital so it can be used there. So they seem to have a good process for making sure that none of it's wasted, because it's a type O, which of course is, you know, the universal donor, and that's, you know, really, it's golden. So it seems like it's there, and some of the research that they've been doing would suggest that this is where it works. They've done clinical trials on it, and maybe this is something we need to do. So what do you think, Joe?
Well, I think there's no question that, blood is a good thing, especially in patients with severe hemorrhage. They need blood volume replaced, and nothing works like blood. And you really touched on, I think, what the issues have been before. I don't think there's been an awful lot of question that it's not the right thing to do. The challenge has been, how do we preserve the blood in a very challenging and austere environment in order to be able to give it to the patient when they need it, not to waste it, not to have to worry too much about blood transfusion reactions and that sort of stuff. And I think some of those issues through some technology now are beginning to be manageable. Again, you addressed a lot of those issues with very, very tightly controlled refrigeration that can maintain, blood in a very narrow temperature range and can record that temperature control so that it can be returned into the general stock when it's not used. Cycling blood out after a very short period of time, a day or two, to keep it very fresh. Blood products in general tend to lose, quote unquote, potency, for lack of a better term, over time. The clotting factors and that sort of stuff tend to degrade a bit over time. So fresh blood is much better than blood that's been packaged and sitting in a refrigerator for several weeks.
But given the alternative of nothing, I guess, that's a good thing. So I was noticing in the Victoria, Australia article, they've given it, this helicopter service has given it more than 70 times, mostly on multiple trauma car accidents. There was an explosion. There even had an Irish backpacker who had an ectopic pregnancy and was way out there. So in those cases, maybe some lives were saved. And cost-wise, it's £150 per unit. So if I remember, having been in the UK recently, it's probably close to $200 a unit. But when you talk about the difference between saving a life or not, or saving brain tissue or not, I mean, that cost is really not a big deal.
Oh, I agree with you. I mean, it's just a logistically very challenging product to deal with. The way most services have managed to get that done, and I think the majority of systems so far have been air ambulance-based services, primarily because the sickest of the sick, the hurtest of the hurt, tend to flow to air medical transport, and their opportunity to use blood is much, much greater than an individual ground EMS service might be. So, from a return on investment, it makes sense to go with an air medical service. But there's no question that the ability to give that those products in the field makes a big difference.
Joe, I think for the benefit of our audience and maybe for me and Sam as well, in some cases, blood is broken down into different types of packaged products. And so we talked about, Sam was talking about packed red blood cells versus freeze-dried plasma. that are carried in these ambulance services. What can you explain briefly what the differences between these two things are, and what advantages each of them have versus maybe some of the downsides?
Well, plasma, for example, is just blood that's had the red blood cells removed. It's sort of everything else that's left over. So it contains the clotting agents and many of those kind of components. The nice thing about being able to freeze those to some extent is that the packaging is fairly small. They can be frozen fairly solid, which makes them much easier to store, transport, and preserve. The downside is, of course, you have to get them out of refrigeration. You have to thaw them out, warm them up, prior to being able to give those to the patient. So, there's again a bit of logistics behind ensuring that there's not a cross match type issue. You have to warm it up. You have to not get it too warm. You have to reconstitute it, as it were, and then be able to deliver it to the patient. As opposed to whole blood, which as we've already talked about, is not ever frozen because it tends to destroy many of the clotting properties, et cetera, when it is. So it is maintained near freezing, but in very tightly controlled temperatures. It has the advantage of having all the products to it. But again, the issue in most cases is just that the logistics behind blood are pretty challenging. The shelf life is short. The requirements for keeping the product stable and ready to use and preventing degradation are pretty strict. And so for most services, the solution has been a fairly quick rotation, a association and affiliation with a blood bank, whether that's part of a hospital system or a freestanding blood bank, that can help to ensure that the product is cared for the way it needs to be cared for, it's preserved the way it needs to be done, it's cycled out very quickly, it's rotated off the helicopter back into more controlled circumstances in a fairly short period of time. And for most services, that's just a day or two. Every other day, they may swap out their blood products and put them back into the hospital rotation. You got to be close enough to a center to be able to do that, and you have to have the logistics support and the financial support to continue to do that on a regular basis and to ensure that the blood products that you're carrying are going to do what it is that you're carrying them for.
So it sounds like that this is not something, I mean, we're not going to see blood products on every single ambulance. It's just logistically not really making sense to do that. It does make sense to put them on air ambulance services that are dealing with transporting and managing multi-system trauma patients and getting them to the trauma center, or maybe even a supervisor's vehicle in a given system where they could be dispatched to a trauma situation or a situation that requires them to possibly need to administer the blood. That sounds like that's the way it really makes the most sense.
I think you're exactly right, Jamie, and that's pretty much been the story so far with it, in that the transport times may be quite prolonged. Austere environment, use of blood products, there's not an awful lot of data out there about it. I think the thought behind the use of it in those situations is that the transport times are very long to definitive care, and without blood, the patient may not well survive long enough to get to definitive care. So, in those situations, it might make more sense to do that. You also tend to have much longer transport times and transports in situations that are much more physically challenging, for example, off a mountaintop or out of a jungle or situations like that where the ground transportation, et cetera, is going to be very challenging and very prolonged.
Well, that's like the hiker that the Australians had that had an ectopic way back in the outback or wherever she happened to be. I mean, that probably saved her life. So, Joe, do you ever see this potentially happening in our disaster setting, either with a DMAT or a USAR, where they might fly it into us, or we have a means of getting it to us and then getting the patient out. Do you see that as a possibility?
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. You know, I think it would require a fair number of confluences to sort of come together. You wouldn't want to pack up a whole bunch of blood and take it out just in case without a very robust logistics system to make certain that it stayed protected and cold and all the stuff we've been talking about. And the possibility of use is relatively small. I could certainly see it in a situation where you had a fairly focused area of damage or impact from whatever, where you knew that the likelihood of severely traumatized patients was pretty high, and you could establish a logistics support train from, you know, wherever the blood was originating out to the scene, and then the patients back to definitive care. So, you know, I could see it in a single building with lots of victims entrapped that was damaged by a terrorist activity, or maybe even an earthquake in Nepal, where you know, there's lots and lots of people that are pretty severely injured in remote areas that are going to require fairly prolonged extrication plus a long transport back to definitive care.
Well, that's what I was thinking about, because I've learned from you so much about crush injuries, because you did such, I think it was EMS Today where you did that great lecture on that. And I was wondering about it in that kind of scenario where they may also have trauma. Would it be helpful in a crush situation just alone, or would it just be a function of associated trauma?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I don't know that there's much sort of studied in regards to that, but I think if you know, crush is a very complex disease process that has sort of several things going on. One of the things that tends to happen is when you reperfuse a crushed area, the vasculature tends to be terribly disrupted, and in essence, a lot of fluid and blood, of course, just flows into the soft tissues there because the vasculature has been destroyed. So, you know, a patient could very quickly go into a hypovolemic state, relatively speaking, because they just emptied out their circulating blood volume into a leg or something that had been severely crushed. And so, you know, refilling the tank with fresh blood obviously would have a great potential there. I don't know that it would do anything directly in regards to the crush itself, but I think it could help stabilize the hemodynamic shock that may come along with crush and reperfusion.
Interesting. Well, who knows? I mean, if this really catches on and they have good success with it, you know, in the helicopter services, maybe that seems a more likely next place to go with it than even, you know, ambulances on the street, unless they're very rural. So who knows? It may take a while for it to be adopted, of course, at our federal level, but it certainly, we couldn't rule it out.
Yeah, I know here in Maryland, you know, we have the Shock Trauma Center at University of Maryland has a GO team that is able to be called out, and is a helicopter transport team of, I think, two physicians and two trauma nurses with supplies to do field amputations and things like that. When you have someone entrapped in such a way that they can't be freed immediately, you can call the GO team to be brought out to you by helicopter. And I do believe they carry some blood products with them. So this is something, you know, that can be assembled with, as Joe said, the proper attention and care to managing the blood products and properly maintaining them in the proper condition so they can be returned to the blood supply if they're not used. You know, there are systems out there that are using these blood products in the field for purposes of managing patients in very specific situations in different ways.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. I got another question for you, Joe, and I know we got to wrap up here pretty quick, but I was really interested in this, and maybe it's worth more discussion, especially since you're doing so much research on CPR and some new things right now. But I saw another article about paramedics giving a cocktail to someone who's either pre-MI or having an MI that's a cocktail of glucose, insulin, and potassium. That some of the research is suggesting it can decrease the likelihood of death by 50%, and the whole thing cost about $50. Have you heard about that?
I'm familiar with it. The study is actually a few years old, if I remember right. And, you know, I don't know that it's ever really taken off much beyond that. I think in the bigger picture, those studies did not tend to show as much difference there. And a lot of that has to do with, I think, things like, you know, cell membrane stabilization and metabolism and trying to maintain the cell membrane fairly intact, whether or not that some of that cell death may be related to changes in its ability to maintain adequate potassium and that sort of stuff, and that... much like we do in Crohn's syndrome, you can give insulin and glucose to a patient who is hyperkalemic, that is, their potassium level in their blood blood space is very high, and that helps to carry that potassium inside the cell. And so I think some of that research was looking at it from the same perspective that we look at it in Crohn's syndrome.
Yeah, well, this particular recent study was saying it's really effective for severe ST elevation heart attacks, and in this particular study that had immediate treatment resulted in a 60% reduction in risk. So it looks like something that's kind of on a cutting edge of getting more data on it, so it might be interesting to see where that goes. And you've been doing so much research, it's pretty awesome. So I'm going to be really curious what you come back with in your bag from Australia and some of the other folks that you talk to down there, and then how you're going to translate that into the education that you guys do at Paragon, because I'm sure you will. So can't wait for that.
Yeah, what's on the horizon for you guys? Because I know Jim wasn't able to make it to EMS World Expo because you actually had additional training going on in addition to what you were doing at Expo. Jim was somewhere else doing some other training. So you guys have been pretty busy. I know a lot of systems are really finding the benefits of that experiential training to help them be prepared for things like active shooter incidents, to help them be prepared for actual disasters by bringing groups together and giving them that stress immersion training. So what's up with you guys? What are you up to in the next few weeks or months?
Well, we've got a little bit of a break after a really crazy busy fall. I think the next thing we have coming up are a couple of classes that incorporate confined space medicine and some rescue medicine. We'll be probably at the Special Operations Medicine Association meeting, SOMA, right at the end of the year, which is Special Operations Military, doing some work with those guys at the same time, and I think some additional training for the military is coming up for us here locally in the next month or so. And then lots of activity early next year with some major training in South Florida, and probably a couple of things going on at EMS today. So it's going to be even busier than EMS World was.
Wow. So, I mean, but there's probably room for more. So if somebody wants to reach out to you guys, and I'm sure you can fit them in somewhere, somehow, if they want to bring Paragon in to give them some of this amazing training that you guys put together, where can they find you?
Well, we're on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com, and we're in the process of updating our website to make it a bit more user-friendly and explain what we do a little bit better. They can find us on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU. And they can always find us through the Disaster Podcast.
Excellent. Well, you know, Joe, and we appreciate your support. You guys have really are the ones that have got Disaster Podcast brought us together to do this show and provide this amazing information to people every single week. And we do appreciate that support. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for everything the Paragon does.
Well, certainly our pleasure. We love to teach. And we really love to talk about disaster medicine. So thanks for being an awesome host and making the podcast work.
So, Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, in the usual social media places, Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and on disasterpodcast.com. And if I ever get it finished, maybe my novel website, but I'm still working on that. So
we're going to get you on that, Sam. That's the next project for us.
That's the next project. I'm almost there. So maybe Joe will have a book in him by the time he goes to Australia. Who knows?
There you go.
Like you had time to write one.
Yeah, I got time to do that.
Good deal. Well, we'll work on that too.
Maybe in a couple of years it'll come out.
There you go.
Yeah. And you can find me over at PodMedic under any of the social media sites. You can find my other programs and various shows over at MedicCast.com. And, of course, at DisasterPodcast.com, where we want you to come back and check out all of our episodes. And if you have a question that comes up when you're listening to an episode, all you got to do is go to DisasterPodcast.com. Find that episode and click on that episode article, and at the bottom of the link there, the page, will have a place where you can leave a nice comment. And we want you to leave your questions, your comments, your thoughts for future episodes all over there at disasterpodcast.com so that we can get back in touch with you. If you have a question for Dr. Joe, you want to find out more about what USAR teams do and how you can become part of one of these teams, we can get that information to you. So leave those questions and comments over at disasterpodcast.com, and we will get back to you. When you leave a comment there, it actually emails us, so we can get back to you pretty quickly. So please do that. And, talking about blood products and all kinds of different things that are maybe new to some of the people listening to the program, Sam, it brings us back to our standard ending for every show, because it seems to be the same every time we come back to this.
Yes, it is. That disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine. And I hope that if we have any Australians out there, that you might run into Dr. Joe here in a couple weeks. And hopefully you'll have some thoughts and questions for us. So let's go international here.